Today I'm joined by John Dutton, OBE. John's career in sport has spanned three decades across multiple sports, and John is the first person on the podcast with British honours as well. So no pressure, John.
Thank you.
So John, diving straight in, you spent in your early career in sport around 6 years on the European Tour, including being at the 1997 Ryder Cup in Valderrama. Working at that level of major sport, early doors, and delivering those events, what did it teach you about delivering those events in golf?
I think I'd just start one step back. I wanted to be a professional rugby player, and I realised probably at the age of 17 or 18, I was neither good enough nor brave enough. I did a degree in sport management at Northumbria University and just had an enormous desire and passion to work in sport. And I guess I was in the right place at the right time, 22 years of age, and got a job working on the European Golf Tour. I was handed my schedule, which said something like Thailand, Dubai, Qatar, Morocco, Portugal, follow the sun, basically, from the start of the year. As you said, Phil, 97, Ryder Cup at Valderrama, got the opportunity to live out there for a number of months in preparation. The golf course was immaculate. Tiger Woods, I think he was 18, making his debut in the Ryder Cup. We had torrential weather, thunderstorms, rain, a bit of sun mixed in. And of course, Europe, captained by Severiano Ballesteros, went on to lift the Ryder Cup. And that just really fueled my passion. First of all, for events, I've spent the majority of my career in and around major events, but also just working with athletes. And yeah, probably young, naive, 22 years of age, got to travel the world. It was just an incredible experience.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And obviously events will be a theme of this podcast, which leads nicely to the next question. So after your time in golf, you were operations director for the Rugby League World Cup in 2013. And then led the Tour de France Grand Depart in Yorkshire in 2014. And that role did plant a seed for what happened later with British cycling. What were the key lessons for you during that period of event delivery that stayed with you for those bigger leadership roles that followed later down the line?
Yeah, it was a great grounding for the rest of my career. The 2013 Rugby League World Cup was incredibly ambitious. Obviously, it came after London 2012. We were the next cab off the rank in the UK. That was pretty daunting, it is fair to say. But we delivered something that was really special. I mean, I think still to this day, it's the record international crowd for any game, which was Australia versus New Zealand at Old Trafford. 74,000 people watched that. And we worked as a team, obviously cheering England on in the background. And England lost in one of the most epic rugby league games ever. At Wembley, Sean Johnson crashing over the line to knock them out, and Australia went on to face New Zealand. But we were a team of a handful of people, 21 venues across four countries, England, Wales, Ireland and France. And I think that what that role taught me, I was the operations director working into the general manager. It was time to roll our sleeves up, manage risk, and I guess ride what was a tidal wave at the time. People still remember fondly 2012. They wanted to come and watch and consume enjoyable events. It was an event staged predominantly in the north of England. Nothing but happy memories. My word, we worked hard. It was a push, to say the least. And worked with the great Sally Bolton, who is chief executive at the All England Club. So coming to Sally's final Wimbledon. So fond memories of working with Sally on that event. And 2014, the Tour de France Grand Depart was something else, an event not delivered in a stadium. No one had to buy a ticket. No one had to come through a turnstile. And millions, literally millions of people lined the sides of the roads in Yorkshire for the first two stages and then from Cambridge through to London. I had the role of the Director of Readiness.
Okay.
And it is fair to say when I came in, it took me about 72 hours to realise we'd never be ready. And the event happened anyway. And the event was amazing. And everyone pulled together. We're in some incredibly rural locations in Yorkshire. Many people will remember Mark Cavendish. It was all set up for Mark to win on the finish line in Harrogate. And he crashed, dislocated his shoulder coming into the final stage. So, just that preparedness, that readiness, the ability to be agile I think with some lessons that I learned through those projects. But also, I realized I was in a privileged position and I also tried to take it in. And that's my advice to many people now embarking on the career. Sometimes you're just in the most amazing sports stadia or meeting the amazing athletes or just involved in some iconic sporting moments and the ability to just pause, reflect, take a moment, take it all in.
Try and enjoy it.
And try and enjoy it. And I certainly did. And rugby league is my passion. I then continued a slightly more challenging event a little later in my career in rugby league, which we may well touch on. And of course, cycling, it's sort of come full back round in the Tour de France. And yeah, two very different events and very different to what happened on the European Golf Tour. But events bring people together. That's really special. And people come as families, as friends to make memories. And yeah, we should always remember that. And when it's a tribal nature of Premier League football, watching your team or that special event moment. And I think you go back to London 2012 and many people will remember how special that was for the nation and how that's filtered out into lots of amazing sporting events that the UK have stepped forward and staged.
Certainly has. And one of those events was the 2021 Rugby World Cup in England. So secured a massive amount of government funding to bring that here. And then unfortunately COVID happened and it was derailed for a year. But how did you keep your team motivated during that year? And what did you learn about yourself as a leader during that time?
It was the most challenging moment of my professional career. There's no doubt about that. And we reflected on 2013. I was also involved in the Rugby World Cup in 2017 in Australia, New Zealand and Papua New Guinea. But 2013 in the UK was great. That record crowd, people came and had a great time. But we had the opportunity to do something more, something bigger and better. And we went to government in 2015. We convinced them to give us a big slug of money, not just into the tournament, but into a social impact program, and in particular into capital facilities to leave a long-lasting legacy. And the project got off to an amazing start. We submitted our bid, we won the bid, we got the government funding, everything appeared great. And then the EU referendum came around, and that was the first bump in the road. And we submitted our bid book the day before the EU referendum. So Wednesday bid book, Thursday EU referendum. We had George Osborne and David Cameron as our two bid sponsors.
Right.
And then by the Friday, they both resigned after they lost the referendum. So we thought that Brexit was probably the biggest challenge that we were going to face. Of course, little do we know, fast forward to March 2020, and the pandemic came around. We held the draw in the January of 2020 at Buckingham Palace, Prince Harry's last public engagement before he went to North America. And again, we just thought, this is a bump in the road, but we got incredible media coverage from that. Felt pretty good. And then, of course, the whole world was turned upside down. It was incredibly challenging. In the early days, we were always convinced that we'd be able to stage the tournament, which was due to happen in October 2021. And part of the challenge was, even though the UK was managing dealing with the pandemic, some of the rest of the world, in particular Australasia, where a lot of the players were coming from, there was a lag in terms of how they were dealing with the pandemic and the impact that had on the community. So I think 100 days out, we just stood on the steps of Downing Street with Boris Johnson, lifting the trophy in celebration for what was ahead. And then days later, we were faced with an incredible decision after Australia and New Zealand withdrew.
Yeah.
And we were faced with three options sat around the board table. We could either carry on without the world's best athletes. We could walk away and just say, we spent a lot of money, we spent a lot of time, and that was it. Or we could postpone and go again in 12 months' time, which is exactly what we did. The second part of the story, Phil, is that 12 months then was incredibly challenging because we had to renegotiate. I think it was 175 different agreements.
Okay.
So all of the stadia, we lost Anfield. Anfield was our quarterfinal venue, but due to the building work that was due to take place, we lost Anfield. We lost a few other venues, and we had to reconstruct the venues schedule. We had to renegotiate broadcast contracts, sponsor contracts. We had to sign up all the teams again through participation agreements and so on. And that, I learned a lot about myself in terms of resilience. When we decided to postpone, I took it quite personally. I felt a sense of guilt that we weren't able to follow through on our promises. And it was that reflection, speaking to my wife, my family, some people surrounding me that built the resilience and that determination to go again. But yeah, it was incredibly difficult. It impacted a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it put into perspective some of the things that we were doing. We're not on the front line saving lives, but it had a huge impact on the athletes. Some of the female athletes planning for a family around participating in the World Cup. Some of the other athletes, the first time ever that they would have been away and played an international tournament. So you start to put into perspective some of the impact that that decision made. But fast forward 12 months, the tournament came, 61 games, 500,000 spectators, incredible audiences on the BBC. But most importantly for us, we delivered a trailblazing social impact program. And that for me was the number one objective when we started the project.
Certainly did. And I remember lots of events post-COVID, you really had that raw atmosphere that was back into stadiums, which was, I think people enjoyed the events a lot more because of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had some big venues. We started in Newcastle at St. James's Park, which was a real sort of celebration and whet the appetite for what was ahead. And then we came all the way through to the Friday evening, the England team lifting the wheelchair trophy mm-hmm. at Manchester Central in front of an absolutely packed house. That was some moments. And then the next day, Australia men and Australia women lifting the trophies at Old Trafford. It was 6 weeks of a tournament. 61 games, 37 days, 21 venues. It was utterly exhausting, but really proud of what the team delivered. And it was very easy when we got to postponement to leave behind some of our social impact aspirations and really double down on negotiating contracts and commercial deals. And we didn't do that. And I think that was a real testament to the determination that the team had to deliver against its original objectives.
Yeah. And following the World Cup, you received your OBE. So things obviously did go very well.
It's incredibly humbling. I mean, that it's just amazing to be recognised, but it was for the team. And it wasn't just me that rolled my sleeves up and did the hard yards. It took many people. You know, the saying, it takes a village. It did take a village to deliver that tournament, not once, but having to go again and effectively deliver it twice. But yeah, an incredible experience for my family to be at Buckingham Palace and just a wonderfully humbling moment.
So moving from rugby league to your role as CEO of British Cycling in 2023, two very different organisations, different cultures, different political environments. What drew you to the role and what did you find when you actually got into the role?
Yeah, I remember vividly the first of what was quite a lengthy recruitment process. But my first interview and the usual question, why do you want the job? And I said, serendipity. I said, there are three things. Number one, I love cycling. Tour de France super fan. Stood on the Champs-Élysées in 1989, watching Greg LeMond beat Laurent Fignon. Okay. Obsessed by the Tour de France. And what an incredible privilege to be working with the Tour de France organisers. Number one was cycling. Number two was challenge. I knew how hard the role was going to be. It certainly delivered against that. It's ticked every box. But the organisation had lost its confidence, lost its way, and I felt that I could add some value to that. So number two is challenge. And then number three, and I think this is really special, is I live in the Northwest, and British Cycling are headquartered in Manchester, the National Cycling Centre. I just think there's something really special about a big, and we are a big national governing body, being headquartered in the north of England. So they were my original three pitches, and you know, everything that I expected and a bit more sort of followed through. I was given three objectives when I finally got the job: to create efficiency, to grow revenue, and to invest into growth. And we've embarked on a phenomenal modernization program, which will continue long after I leave. And it's been some ride. Paris was a huge moment for us in terms of performing on the field, both in the Olympics and Paralympics. We deliver events like the Lloyd's Tour of Britain, mm-hmm. which we've resurrected. And of course, we've got the Tour de France Grand Départ in 2027 coming back.
Yeah.
And I've been involved in that project pretty much since day one in helping a small team of people, helping bring that back to the UK. And that's bigger than ever before, because we've not just got the Tour de France men, we've also got the Tour de France femmes, the Tour de France women, which will be a national moment and incredibly special for people across the communities that can stand at the side of the road and watch it.
Yeah, and one of those stages is finishing about 15 minutes down the road from here. So great spectacle.
It is. I mean, there was some journey with the ASO, the Amore Sports Organisation. So Tour de France is owned by a private family, and we've certainly got to know them pretty well. I mean, they are amazing at what they do. And in the early days, they came with a small shopping list of cities, places that they wanted to visit. Edinburgh was right up there, and we're starting the men's race in Edinburgh. But Liverpool was on the list. And what we've had to do is create a route that makes sense around the wish list of cities. It's going to be epic, amazing, spectacular. Liverpool will put its best foot forward, as will all of the other places. And what an occasion to go to Scotland, Wales, and to England across six stages, men and women. Yeah, it's just going to be amazing. We expect about 12 million people to stand by the side of the road, to put that into perspective. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
It is.
And hopefully the sun will shine, and then people will come along and have street parties. And yeah, just whether you like cycling or not, just that national moment of bringing people together.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And John, your time at British Cycling, it was, when you arrived, it was a difficult time to say the least, not just for the organisation, but for national and governing bodies more broadly. So you've touched on a couple of the changes you made there, but why do you think those changes were necessary? And what do you think that lasting impact has been?
I think it's an ongoing conversation, Phil, about financial sustainability across national governing bodies. British Cycling are one of the larger national governing bodies, but everyone receives public funding to spend either on the team, on the field of play, or to invest into getting more people active. And for us, we were financially challenged. We had some reputational issues. We also had a cultural challenge. And I just sum it up, as I said before, that the organisation had lost its confidence. And to work through with a team of people, a really talented team of people, to try and get the flywheel moving, to gain the momentum, and then start to see some amazing things happen. But as per every one of the 31 years of my career, it's about people. It's about building confidence. It's about inspiring people to be at the best, feel supported, feel challenged. And that, yeah, I don't think that's any different for any other national governing body organisation, certainly in sports. Mm-hmm. But I think it's there is a big conversation about the UK sporting system, of how we can create more efficiency, how we can support amazing athletes to do their thing, live their dream. But probably as importantly, how we can get more people active, healthy, moving, and contribute to the government agenda. And I think cycling is so special that it's a form of travel.
Yeah.
It is a life skill. It is ubiquitous. And we know from our market research that 30 million people have gotten a bike at least once in the last 12 months. 30 okay. million people. And that's astonishing. And that number can contribute to growth and productivity and economic prosperity. And I think that we are playing a greater role in that than ever before. And yeah, I'm really proud of some of the pointing in the right direction. I was going to say leadership. I think leadership is about how you make people feel. And if that person feels they can perform at the best, they're contributing, you'd start to do that at scale. And then all of a sudden the thing does start to move. But it's been challenging, exciting, fulfilling, uplifting. It will be an emotional moment when the time comes to leave.
Yeah. And leading to the next question. So yeah, obviously that time is quite soon. You've recently been appointed as CEO of the British Olympic Association, arguably one of the most significant roles in British sport. So you've got LA on the horizon in 2028 and then the Winter Olympics following that. What does the job actually require from yourself? And what do you think is most relevant from your career to date? What can you bring into that role?
I mean, what an absolute privilege, what an honour. Also, I still pinch myself. I never thought I'd be a national governing body chief executive. I certainly never thought I'd be chief executive of Team GB. And the role found me. Again, a lengthy recruitment process. But yeah, when Catherine Granger rang me up and said she'd like me to be her next chief executive, I probably for the first time in my career was speechless. So incredibly humbling, but I'm there to hopefully make a difference. the organization's in great shape. Really talented executive team, more financially sustainable, much more financially sustainable than British Cycling, but with the capability to do much more. And the brand is incredible. The Team GB brand, the vast majority of the UK population recognise and there is resonance with the brand. But we've got to bring that to life and make it show up every day. I think there's more that can be done through the social impact work. There's an amazing foundation who are doing great things, working in schools. But again, it's just that for me is the opportunity is to take something that's already great and make it even greater. And as you said, we've got LA fast coming into view in 2 years' time, which will be an incredibly expensive Olympic Games, but it will be the Hollywood Olympic Games. And I think the way that that comes through our TV screens and into our living rooms in the UK, the experience for people in the venues, I think will be absolutely incredible. And then fast followed by the French Alps and the Winter Olympics. And I know so many people who've talked about Milano Cortina and watching, whether it's a skeleton, whether it's some of the snowcross events, and we've got that to look forward to in our own time zone in the French Alps, and then fast forward to Brisbane in 6 years' time. And again, another expensive Olympic Games, slight challenge on time zone in terms of consuming in the UK. But yeah, for our athletes, for supporters, for people that just love Olympic sports, it's going to be amazing. And of course, we live and coexist in the same facility as the British Paralympic Association, retitled Paralympics GB, and for some of the para athletes as well. So much to look forward to. And that's ahead in a few weeks' time. Can't wait to get started. But yeah, just an incredible privilege, as has all of my career been.
And so the last question now, John, it's more of a personal question to end. 3 decades in across golf, rugby league, cycling, and now the Olympic movement, what does keep driving you forward? This podcast is called My Life in Sport and it focuses on the business side of sport. So what keeps you driving forward, John?
I think I go back to being 5 years old and my dad took me to my first sporting event, which was a game of rugby league. I live in a rugby league town, a town of 45,000 population, and it's been in my DNA. And I've grown up playing sport, played both codes of rugby, played many sports, never been particularly good at any, but I've seen the difference that sport can make. And in my local community, one of my fondest memories was in 2023 when my hometown team, Lee, went to Wembley, lifted the Challenge Cup for the first time in 50 years, though, with my son, my wife. And that just really resonated about how special that was and reaffirmed, if I even needed it, the role that sport has played in my life. And all the things that we've talked about, Phil, all of those amazing things, I will pick out one event, which was in 2010, that we haven't talked about, and it's the World Blind Football Championships.
Okay.
That was at the Royal National College for the Blind in Hereford. It was a qualifier for London 2012 for the Paralympics. And it was that event for me, working with blind athletes in a facility, and we literally did everything from the broadcast, the ticketing, to the marketing. The whole lot was done by a small team of people. And that, for me, I go back to that as just so proud, so enjoyable. And bizarrely, the team captain of England, a chap called Dave Clark, who is now the chief executive of Paralympics GB.
Right.
And yeah, it's
full circle moment.
Full circle for both of us. We're both from the north of England, very proud of that. But yeah, all of that just sort of brings to life the power of sport, how it can make a difference to people's lives. And I'm convinced if we can carry on supporting our athletes to be at the best, we can also deliver societal benefits as well. And yeah, hopefully whenever I step off and finish my career, if I can reflect back and know that I've made a difference, then that will do for me.
Well, certainly have to date. Fascinating career in sport and really looking forward to seeing the Tour de France in Liverpool. Yeah, the Olympic movement and the Paralympic movement going forward. So yeah, been a pleasure, John. And thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.